This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. Late last week, Governor J.B. Pritzker announced a rare veto of legislation the General Assembly passed earlier this year. Lawmakers who supported this billed it as a way to protect workers at warehouses, but Pritzker said, essentially, that the proposal left more questions than answers. Here to talk about that and more in our Friday political review is Jeremy Gorner, who covers Illinois state government for the Chicago Tribune. Jeremy, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Brian. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being here. So tell us a little bit more about the motivation behind this warehouse legislation.
Yeah, so basically, Brian, this bill was aimed at providing protections for workers at large warehouses. It was passed in early January during the lame duck session, and it was in response to reports that warehouse workers are too often pushed beyond their physical limits. For example, in December, Amazon reached a $145,000 settlement with the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration over accusations that the conditions at one Illinois warehouse left workers exposed to elevated risks of injury. So basically what this legislation would have done is that it would have required workers to be more open about productivity. It would have required employers to be more open about productivity expectations and ensure employees don't miss breaks because of their workloads. Pritzker vetoed the bill, however, because he believed that, you know, that there was no procedure in place to ensure due process in the enforcement of the legislation, or if it were to become law. And there was no, in a letter on Friday, he said there was no, quote, clear, comprehensive scheme, end quote, for civil penalties and damages that could result from violations of the measure. And Pritzker also said it was unclear, who in this law, and if it were to become law, would be covered. Who would this law apply to, basically? So basically, he said he's directing his office, the governor's office, and the Illinois Department of Labor, to convene workers' advocates, unions, and pro-business interests, basically to work together on a proposal, to address these concerns. The local chapter of the Teamsters, which was one of the main supporters of the bill, says that they were blindsided by this veto. The director of government affairs for Teamsters Joint Council 25 said he met with the Department of Labor several times after the legislation was passed on potential follow-up bills to address any concerns that still may be out there. He was kind of taken aback by this, especially because in the governor in his letter said that the measure was passed, quote, hastily and, quote, without engagement with relevant state agencies, which, the Teamsters representative thought that was perplexing, considering he said that he had been in contact with the Department of Labor several times over the last couple of years to address concerns. So looks like there's a lot going on there that still needs to be hashed out, as with any veto with the governor, because it is so rare that he takes a step like this with legislation.
Yeah. Just not that many vetoes when you have typically the General Assembly quite, Democratic supermajority quite in sync with the Democratic governor. I noticed it's a different department at the Chicago Tribune, the editorial page. I know you don't have anything to do with that, but they were praising him as sort of doing like a pro, goes to bat for Illinois' business climate, taking hits from the unions. So I guess that sort of sums up, where some of the reaction to this has been.
Well, yeah. I mean, I will say, too, that, there were opponents of the legislation, include like the Illinois Chamber of Commerce and the Illinois Manufacturers Association, some of these pro-business groups who have a prominent voice in business policy in Illinois. They expressed concerns that the bill would negatively affect businesses' operations. Like for instance, the Manufacturers Association, they said in a statement last week, in response to the governor's veto, their quote was that it would have imposed extremely onerous restrictions on warehouse operators in Illinois, especially considering manufacturing represents the single largest share of Illinois' economy, according to the group. So Clearly, they have a lot of interest in any policy like this. But obviously, the Teamsters beg to differ. So I guess we'll have to see what happens next.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are a bit past the midpoint of this year's legislative session. There was a big deadline for lawmakers last week. Bills need to get out of committee in order to stay alive. It's one of these sort of steps that they have to go through on the road to becoming a law. One of the proposals that I know you've written about is has to do with public defenders in Illinois,
sure.
lawyers who provide legal representation to people who can't afford it otherwise. What are lawmakers looking to do there?
Well, you know, basically this, you know, this doesn't affect every single county in Illinois. When you look at bigger counties like Cook County and DuPage County, you know, they're probably in better shape when it comes to providing public defense for indigent clients than rural counties. I mean, this is legislation that would really benefit any counties in Illinois that are starving for resources when it comes to public defense. I mean, there are some counties that don't have a full-time chief public defender. I mean, there's instances where you have like a chief public defender who covers multiple counties on contract. They're like a private defense attorney, basically contracted out by, you know, two or maybe three counties at once in some cases. It just shows you that there's just not enough public defenders in Illinois. Whereas, you know, give you an example, if county prosecutors, for example, Brian, need help during the trial, they can enlist the help from the Illinois Attorney General's office, and they could provide legal representation. They could provide, you know, prosecutorial help in certain cases to assist state's attorneys. Public defenders in the counties don't have those kinds of that kind of help. They don't have those kinds of resources. So that's what this bill would do, is it would create an office of a statewide public defender. And, you know, they would provide funding and resources and manpower. And when I say resources, it could be anything from like, evidentiary experts. You know, they need somebody, if a public defender in a small county needs expert help on like DNA or forensics or anything like that, that's what this office would do. They would assist with that. One of the things is that this office, what this office would not do is alter the operations of these counties and how they approach public defense. They would be there more they would be there more for assistance. But what's the sticking point here is that, unlike state's attorneys who are elected by the people, public defenders are generally appointed by circuit court judges or a chief judge. And the concern there is that, there's concerns that the bill does not do enough to enable public defenders to be independent from the judiciary. You know, like it doesn't
oh, interesting.
Do anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't do enough to make public defenders be, not beholden to judges that basically, you know, put them in power.
Put them in the job. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's something that, you know, is going to probably be discussed in the coming weeks, in the coming months. And this was something, if you recall, was introduced last year by Senate President Don Harmon. And they've been having conversations ever since.
All right, Jeremy Gorner with the Chicago Tribune. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Great. Thanks, Brian.
This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Now to national politics, where the big story this week has been that senior national security officials were sharing what seems to be classified information on an encrypted but public messaging app, discussing attack plans that, you know, should probably not be shared on a public messaging app. We know about this because National Security Advisor Michael Waltz apparently accidentally added the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine to the chat. Here to talk about this and more is Illinois Public Media's Washington correspondent, Linda Kenyon. I should mention we taped this conversation with Linda on Thursday evening. Probably 18 more news events will happen between now and when this actually goes to air. But Linda, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brian. You're absolutely right. Probably at least 18 more news items will happen between now and when the show airs.
So, all right. So this app is called Signal. I have it on my phone. I know a lot of reporters and political people have it on their phones. don't know if we can just start briefly, like, what is it and what makes this such a departure from how these sorts of, you know, discussions among top national security officials have happened in the past?
Well, I think that the American people were pretty startled to learn that this commercially available end-to-end encryption app called Signal was being used by our top government officials, especially our top intelligence officials, including the National Security Advisor, the Defense Secretary, and others. And it is supposed to be encrypted. But if you invite a reporter into a chat room, there's nothing that can stop that information from going out. I will say that the reporter thought it was odd he was invited into this chat. He was part of the thread of those who were included. He realized it was a national security matter, did not publish any of the information until after it occurred. What is it? It is the attack plans, including the weaponry involved, the type of aircraft, targets, locations, timing, etc., of the U.S. attack on March 15th against Houthi rebels in Yemen. Now, the U.S. attacked them because they have been consistently attacking U.S. Navy vessels in the Red Sea, along with commercial shipping. And so the Trump administration ordered this attack to occur. This app was being used just about 2 hours before the attack was set to launch. And it was Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, who added all of this information that, by any uneducated guess, would appear to be classified information, and certainly by an educated guess as well. Now, there were two hearings on Capitol Hill about this week. There's been numerous outcry about it. President Trump, however, seems to be kind of shrugging it off. In fact, we asked him in the Oval Office a question about why he seemed to be downplaying this, and he said, "I'm not downplaying it. The media is upplaying it." One of the members of Congress from one of the congressional hearings did say that she served in the military, and if even somebody as a low-ranking person, as a private, had leaked any of the information that was discussed in this chat, that person would not only have been fired, but would probably spend some time in the brig. So why was it allowed to occur in such a public fashion? That is going to be the root of a number of investigations, and one of them will be led by Senator Roger Wicker, who is in fact the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And a lot of Republicans and Democrats alike are very upset about this.
Yeah, and among them is Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth, herself a veteran, who said in a statement, quote, "Pete Hegseth is a bleeping," it's a word that starts with F, "a bleeping liar. He needs to resign in disgrace immediately." I mean, as you said, this is getting reaction not only from Democrats, some Republicans who have been supportive of this administration. They did just confirm Pete Hegseth and Tulsi Gabbard and many of the other people who were on this chat recently. Do you get the sense? Is this really going to change anything?
I would say with each passing hour, there's more and more calls for resignations. President Trump, however, again, seems to be shrugging it off. He says Mike Waltz, the National Security Advisor, he admitted that he's the one who added this reporter, the editor-in-chief from the Atlantic magazine, to the chat, and he took responsibility. He also, when asked if Pete Hegseth should resign, and he said, "Why are you bringing Pete into this?" He said, "Pete had nothing to do with this." And so, again, it just seems like he's sort of shrugging off what could have been a very serious issue. Fortunately, none of the information was leaked ahead of time. And when the president and the press secretary continued to say there was nothing classified in this discussion, there was nothing to worry about, that's when The Atlantic published the discussion. And, of course, it does show a lot of very specific information about a pending attack, which had it been published or disseminated ahead of said attack, could have put American fighter pilots and their very lives at risk. And a number of veterans groups are really not happy about this. And so the question arises, not only who is to be held accountable, but how they will be held accountable, and if the use of this signal encrypting tool, this app, will ever be used again, and if not, what technology will they be using? Because right now, when there is a secure conversation, ideally, the president says, it should occur in a SCIF, a secure room, which is just for that purpose. But sometimes he says you can't get everybody all in the same room at the same time. And so that was the reason for the use of this app instead.
Well, one last thing I want to ask you about. President Trump has been continuing to sign executive orders, doing things that it's not, I guess, how do I put this generously? It's not clear he has the constitutional authority to do all the things he's trying to do through these orders. We saw this week one that, as written, would change how elections are run across the country. And we can get to the substance of that. But I guess the more important question is, constitutionally, who decides how elections are run?
Well, elections are run by individual states. That is the way it is set up. That's the way it's set up constitutionally. And to put a federal rule on everything just is not a one-size-fits-all kind of situation. Some states have in-person voting. Some states have only mail-in ballots. Some states have polls open at certain times, and other states have polls open at other times. This is all a decision made by individual state legislatures. So putting it under the control of the federal government, that's basically ripe for a constitutional challenge.
Linda Kenyon, thank you as always. Try and keep your head about you in D.C. there.
Always a challenge.
More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.